What is it that holds capable, driven people from breaking through to the next level? And the answer to that question, to my great surprise, is success. I first observed this working with executive teams in Silicon Valley, where I noticed that when they were focused on a few things, it led to success. But success breeded so many opportunities and options that diffused the very focus that led to success in the first place. And so exaggerating the point in order to make it, I found that success becomes a catalyst for failure, because it leads to what Jim Collins called the undisciplined pursuit of more. The antidote to that problem is the disciplined pursuit of less, but better. That means exploring the very critical things you want to pursue and being willing to then, number two, eliminate the rest, and number three, build a platform for effortless execution so that doing what is essential becomes the default position, not just the rare occasion.
So you were just listening to Greg McKeown in a video that he did with the Stanford Graduate School of Business. And he's talking about a problem I think all leaders can relate to, which is trying to do it all. You probably fall into this trap of hearing and reading about good ideas on things to do with your team, and then wanting to, and often trying to implement it all or just too much. And this problem doesn't just appear in your leadership challenges, but in your own life. As you take on too much, your to-do lists grow and grow, and the stress builds and builds. You don't know how to say no to the many opportunities that come your way. Well, we're incredibly excited to have Greg on the podcast for the next two episodes to discuss, first, how the essentialism philosophy and discipline is essential for developing the team culture that we aspire. Then secondly, how applying this within our own personal lives can lead to a more fulfilling life. You're listening to the Coaching Culture Podcast. I'm JP Nurbin alongside my co-host, Nate Sanderson. Every week in around 30 minutes, we're giving you strategies and tools for you to grow as a leader and build your culture. We know the reason why most teams struggle, and that is because they have a dysfunctional culture. This leaves coaches frustrated with entitled players, losing seasons, and toxic environments. And at Thrive on Challenge, we believe that the silver bullet is a transformational culture. We help coaches to create and sustain transformational cultures so they can strengthen relationships, raise standards, and inspire others to make an impact. To learn more about our workshops, retreats, and mentorship program, go to thriveonchallenge.com. You can also get the coaching notes PDFs for every Coaching Culture episode by subscribing to our weekly newsletter. You're listening to episode 142, What's Keeping You From Breaking Through to the Next Level, with essentialist Greg McKeown. So before we get into today, just a little bit more about Greg. He's the author of the book Essentialism, The Disciplined Pursuit of Less, which is a New York Times bestseller and a Wall Street Journal bestseller. And it's also the number one time management book on Amazon. His book has had such a profound impact on my coaching that a couple of years ago, I shared some of those thoughts on episode 18 of the Coaching Culture Podcast. Now, Greg understands organizational culture. His clients include Adobe, Apple, Google, Facebook, Pixar, Salesforce, and the list goes on. He blogs for Harvard Business Review and LinkedIn, and he has recently started his own podcast titled Essentialism, which is a must listen. I've put links in the episode details and in the coaching notes PDF. Now, Greg, we live in a world, especially within the world of business and in sports, where I think people are looking constantly for more ways to do more and more and more. I know personally, when I sit down the night before and I'm planning out my day, I'm thinking, how much can I fit into the next 86,400 seconds? How much can I pack in? But you're not really interested in helping people do more and more. You're actually interested in helping them to do, I think, a little bit less. You know, could you explain a little bit about essentialism and why this kind of philosophy or discipline has been so attractive, even though I think it's pretty countercultural to much of what business and sports are about today?
Yes, I think one of the reasons it's been attractive is because it's countercultural. And the key is that there's a different mindset. So the mindset that I'm offering in Essentialism, the key is in the title, essential. It's to see the world through the lens of what is essential. That is the things that are 90% or above important. And you're scanning for those, you're exploring for those, and then you're trying to eliminate or at least reduce as much as possible everything else so that you can invest your time, energy, resources in those vital few things instead of the trivial many. And as a result, break through to a higher point of contribution personally and professionally. That's what essentialism is.
Now, I know your book, Essentialism, and much of your work, it doesn't just speak to, you know, personal lives, but it also speaks to organizational culture and leadership. You know, I want to take the first part of our conversation down the path of how essentialism can help our team culture and help us as leaders. So from an essentialist perspective, what's one of the biggest problems I think that organizations and teams face as they pursue excellence and success?
Well, I think that there's a paradox of success. In the early days, any team, any organization stumbles around for a little bit until they find something that is clear. Maybe they come across the right idea at just the right time. And that produces options and opportunities. And this all sounds like the right problem to have. You're clear, leads to success, leads to options. That's what everybody wants. But it can, in fact, turn out to be a serious problem if it leads to what Jim Collins has called the undisciplined pursuit of more. And when you fall into the undisciplined pursuit of more, you start to lose the clarity and focus that led to success in the first place. And so even otherwise successful teams will start to reach a certain level and then stay at that level, because they're pursuing all of the different options and opportunities that have come along because of their success. And so in order to break through to a higher level of contribution, to a higher level of success, you must become far more selective. You must increase your selectivity to just above your current level of success, and to do that perpetually.
Now, when it comes to sports teams, which is largely our listeners, their coaches, how might they start to really determine what is essential? You know, like what areas of their program and their coaching might they start to look at?
Well, one thing that just immediately comes to mind for me is that you ought to step aside and explore to not just be so busy doing that you don't step aside and look at what the program is doing. So you must actually create space between you and the team. In a wonderful sports film called Forever Strong, there's a great scene in it from Larry Gelwicks is the coach. It's the story of the Highland High School rugby team. And this is the winningest team basically in American history anywhere. I mean, it's the most extraordinary story. They've played something, I think I've got the numbers right, 326 games over 36 years, and they have won 316 of them. So they've only lost four games in the last decade. They've had 22 national championships. They've, you know, in the US, they've been to all of them, the only team ever to go to all of them. They've won all but three of them. They came runners up twice, and they came third just once. And the time that they came third, the coach told me, he said, well, you know, they were too busy polishing the trophy. So how did he do it? What's the key? Well, I was watching this film and I was fascinated already, but there was a scene in it that pushed me over the edge. And when I saw it, I determined, okay, I'm
not just to watch this film or be inspired by it. I am going to go and meet this person or talk to this person and learn about how this could be possible. And the scene is where he is sitting on the sideline with one player at a time while the practice is going on. They're sitting on deck chairs, and they'll sit there and talk for 20 minutes, half an hour, completely focused on this one individual instead of the rest of the practice. And somehow the rest of the practice is working seamlessly, effortlessly, easily, fluidly. And that was the tipping point for me, as I said, okay, there's something genius going on here, that so much excellence continues without deliberate intervention from the head coach. And so that began a very, a great relationship and an ongoing relationship with Larry Gelwicks. And I've interviewed him, his assistant coaches, past players going back literally a generation now, and trying to learn and get to the very core of how they were able to produce that kind of performance.
Now, you've seen the essentialism approach work in business and organizations. From your perspective, how was it working in his team? How was he applying that already that was helping him deliver those type of results?
He has one question, and that question is layered on through many traditions, rituals, and so on. And I've got to address both of them. In the first place, the question he asks is, what's important now? It's a nice acronym, of course, WIN. Mm-hmm. What's important now? But how does he... And the goal of that is that every player, every staff member can worry about nothing but that question at any given moment. So he is the coach, is able to do it. That's how he's able to be on the sideline talking one-on-one with his team. Mm-hmm. How does he do it? Let me share a few of the ways. One that I thought was so brilliant and unusual is that once you became a player on the team, you would receive letters from past players that played in your number. So the number doesn't change year in and year out. You know, every position has the same number. And so you will get a letter from someone that played in that position 5 years ago on the championship team, or 10 years ago, or sometimes, eventually it's 20 years ago. And you receive a letter about what it meant to play on that team, what it means to play in that position, why they cared so much, how they created such extraordinary unity, all of those things. And so this is an intergenerational approach to support that when somebody goes out onto the pitch, when they are playing, they can play with a sense of clarity that this matters, and why does this matter, and why it isn't about you. So you can rid yourself of all the distracting ego that could easily take you off path. Once ego gets involved, well, you care about what the scoreboard says. Oh, you got to win in that way. And that produces all sorts of unhelpful behavior. Of course, sometimes that's helpful, but it can get people to overinvest in worrying about that instead of what they do in the next play. So let me give an illustration of that. Coach Gelwicks, after the games, will often sit down with his team and say, well, look, did we win? Meaning, did we do what's important now? And after one time they played a game that they won 60-4, something like that. And he says, well, did we win? And someone says, come on, coach. I mean, we just destroyed them. I mean, what difference does it make if we did what's important now? We destroyed them. We went so far ahead of the next person. He said, no, that's not what I do. I'm not interested in what the score was on the board. I don't care about that. The question is whether we did the most important thing in this moment throughout that game. That's the thing we control. The stuff on the scoreboard, that's not what we control. So I'm asking, and they went through this whole evaluation and they concluded that they had not won that game. Even though the scoreboard was, you know, they were, had more points than the other team. And it was that sort of ongoing ingrained process of thinking that freed the team from having to worry about all these non-essential distractions. Well, are we, what's the score on the board? They don't, that's not the focus. Well, did I mess up on the last play? It's not the focus. Did I just score? It's not the focus. We don't care. If you can get a whole team of people to focus on doing the most important thing right now, you give them an execution advantage that is very hard to take away, because you protect them against worrying about what the other team just did, what the game is the other team is playing. You play your game, you do what's important now and what's important next.
Greg, I appreciate you sharing that. And one of the things in reading through your book and listening to some things online that you've done in the past, there's a lot of application to trying to discern the things that are important to do. But I think there's also for coaches an application of the same philosophy to a team's identity. Now, you mentioned the power of the letters coming from past players is really an affirmation of this is who we are, you know, when you don this jersey. And I wonder if you could just speak to that idea of applying the same principles to, you know, a collective identity and how impactful that can be for a team.
I've done this many times in working with teams of various kinds. I ask them all to close their eyes and point north. And if you do that, what you have, there no peeking is allowed until everyone is pointed. And then they get to open their eyes and look around. And what you find is that people are pointing in every single direction, including straight up. And in that little story, I think is an important principle for every team. When you have them pointing in all different directions, of course they're weaker for it. Whatever the individual capability on the team is, they cannot work as a unified whole. So if you can get an even average capability team to all point in the right direction, they can beat a more talented but less unified team. We have many examples to support that idea. So, you know, the question then stems, well, how do you get them to be unified? And really what I would argue is that this is the primary work of the coach. This is not one more thing to do. It's the work. It's every single decision that you make is based on defining one essential intent. So one decision that makes a thousand other decisions. Once you decide what our primary focus will be, you're in fact making hundreds and hundreds of other decisions. Once you decide what your primary focus and identity as a team is, that affects who you would hire. It affects even what players you would accept onto your team. You might say no to someone who's highly talented, highly sought after, but isn't a cultural fit for you. So I am highly in favor of coaches of all kinds getting really clear, not sort of clear, really clear about what their cultural identity is, what they want to be about, and letting that then flow down into all the other decisions. And just see how vitally important this is. From a business point of view, looking for an industry outside of coaching for a second so that we can learn something from a different industry to apply. The question is, why can't Kmart wake up tomorrow morning and be Walmart? It would be better for them. It would be better numbers. It would be more advantageous in 100 ways. So why can't you just copy it? And the reason is because once you set an essential intent, a million decisions follow. And every one of those decisions reinforces who you are and who you aren't. And so this to me is the most important decision that a coach can make. You know, what is the culture that we want to have? Let's get really clear about that. Also, let's have a minimum bound, meaning if somebody violates this culture, we will actually remove them, even if they're one of our star players. Larry Gelwicks has done that in a variety of ways. For him, for example, honesty is part of their culture. That is a deeply important principle. If someone is dishonest on or off the team, they are under the obligation to come and confess that to the coach. There's no like manipulation involved. They don't try and grab someone and say, oh, you have to say. It's just, they just put a clear obligation. Your job is to be honest about that and to come forward about it. Even though everybody involved knows there will be a consequence. Like, for example, you won't play the next game. You won't play in the championship game even. There will be a consequence. But what this has done is it's produced this culture where people do come forward and they are honest about it. And they can get all of that additional reward into the positivity of that culture, that they say, we are about more than winning this game. We are about winning life. And by the way, that does translate into this exceptionally winning team.
Well, I think it's really cool that you share that story of Larry Gelwicks, and that's an amazing movie. I love that movie. And one of the things that stuck out the most about that movie was him sitting on the sideline in that lawn chair having conversations with players. And I think that that comes down to something you also mentioned in your book, is just clarity of your mission. You know, and I'm sure Larry has a very clear mission around what he's trying to do as a coach when it comes to impacting the players on his program, so that he can make those decisions to be a little bit less concerned with maybe teaching the tactics or technical aspects of the game, and maybe it is connecting with those players on that sideline.
Well, I think that one-on-one interaction time, I mean, anybody who's listening to this who happens to be a parent knows how hard it can be to get that one-on-one time with their children, one-on-one time with their spouse. And same is true in the team. It can be very hard to get one-on-one time. So you spend a lot of time in the collective and not much time helping the individual and making that emotional connection. And so it's a paradox here that I did see on Highland High School rugby team, but I've seen it in many other teams as well, where you get the system running well enough, self-sustaining enough, that you can step out of it and start working on the system rather than just always being in the system. If you're always spending the totality of your energy keeping the thing moving forward, then you can't step away to improve your overall approach. So I think that's really the target, is to try to build a self-sustaining system so that you can keep improving it from the outside, keep looking at, pull someone off the team, work with them, get to know them, build more trust, put them back into the team. You're working on the team, not always in the team.
So I think one of the biggest challenges for us as coaches, when we're trying to apply an essentialism philosophy, not just to our team, but to our own lives, is two things, actually. One is that there's so many really good ideas out there. Like you talked about opportunities in the success paradox earlier, just how there's so many good opportunities, but what are the really important ideas to move us forward? So there's lots of really good ideas. That's even probably a problem for some of the coaches that listen to this podcast, is, oh, they get all these different ideas, they don't know where to start to apply them. But I think the second big challenge, and this is a really growing challenge as social media has, I think, amplified this, which is we see what other coaches are doing, the long hours of watching film, the hours on the recruiting trail, you know, just all the webinars that they might attend, all the podcasts they listen to, all the books people read, all the things they try with their team. We see all that, and we try to do all of that and then more. Because if we think, all right, if they're doing that, I've got to do that, and then I've got to find something else to separate myself from the crowd. And that is often the strategy that we are taking as coaches, which is just to add more and more and more of what other people are doing out there.
This fear of missing out is exactly part of the enemy of our story. Because if you get into this fear of missing out or FOMO as your strategy, you no longer understand what you're doing. And you no longer need to. Because you've outsourced your executive function to other people's behavior. Well, they're doing it, so I'm doing it. That's it. There's no more analysis necessary. They're doing it, so I should do it. Best practices. Everybody's doing it. I should be doing it. FOMO. And that's fine if you never want to get better than them. Right? If you want to be like everybody else, well, fine. Then just do what everyone else is doing. I mean, of course, that's what the strategy is. But don't expect to be both distinctive and exceptional and the same as everyone. Right? Like, those are completely diametrically opposed strategies. So this FOMO strategy also inhibits us from getting the insight we actually need to break through to the next level. Mm-hmm. Because we stop creating the space necessary to get our own insight into what we believe we need to do to actually win and be breakthrough in our success. We don't get that insight because we're just too busy doing what everybody else is doing. Once we push that aside and start to study it ourselves, that is, to look for the things that we think really matter. What's our unique mission as a team? What's unique and great about this individual player? What's their highest point of contribution? Push out. Who cares what the other teams are doing? Who cares what they're trying to go after? This comes all the way back to Larry Gerwick saying, what's important now? What's important now is not what they're saying. It's not what they're doing. We're not trying to play their game. We're not trying to copy their strategy. So an alternative strategy to FOMO is the joy of missing out, or JOMO. And you discover JOMO as you start to look deep inside of you, and as you take the time to actually discover those diamonds, and as you discover those diamonds and you define your unique culture and your unique identity as a team and how you're going to go after that end uniquely. As you start to discover all of this, you start to have a tremendously valuable asset, because every decision you make will build upon the last decision. And all of those deliberate trade-offs eventually create an unbeatable strategy. Other people cannot out-execute you on it because you've made different trade-offs to them. It's the equivalent. Let me ask you this question, another business example. If you could put $1 into every one of the S&P 500 companies in 1972, and you keep $1 consistent in each of those companies for the next 30 years, which company gives you the largest return on investment by the end of that 30-year period? What do you think?
I would guess, kind of just shoot for, I don't even want to say GM, but I just know they had a good run there for a while. But
it's a good guess. It's not the answer.
Apple.
Oh, good one. No. Give us another one.
Nate, you got a guess?
I was thinking something in the energy sector, maybe an oil company or a BP or something like that.
Nice. No. We could go on a long time. I know it's a little awkward to even do it right now. this is no fun for us. But I've done this with groups of 500 people, 1,000 people, and we can go on for as long as we want until someone cheats and they look it up online and they get the answer. Nobody knows. And that the reason I'm making the slightly awkward pause here is to help us think about that we don't see it clearly. The company that would give you the largest return on investment is Southwest Airlines. How did they do that? And there's whole volumes that have been written about it, and I've done a, you know, I've done a decent study on that. And I'll tell you this, they didn't get there by trying to be like everybody else in the airline industry. I'll tell you that. They were not trying to do what everybody else was doing. In fact, there's a brilliant little story that that Southwest still tells. Whether it happened or not is harder to say, but they certainly tell it as a story that names something for their culture. Someone had flown Southwest. They didn't enjoy the experience, and they wrote 7 letters in a row complaining about the experience. Herb Kelleher, the co-founder of Southwest, gets those letters and, after reading them, writes a letter in response. And in the letter writes, I've received your letters. I'm thankful that you sent them, and I have a suggestion for you. I think what you need to do going forward is to fly Continental. So what's the point of that story is that they knew who they were and who they weren't so clearly that it allowed them to not to make decisions quickly. They weren't trying to be Continental. They were trying to be a hub-to-hub, stateside airline, low-cost carrier. Meanwhile, over at Continental, incidentally, for years and years, they just ignored Southwest. You know, they don't even know. They don't even know what an airline is. They're not a serious player. We're the real thing here. But after several years of having just dismissed them, and Southwest being consistent with their strategy, layering on trade-off after trade-off in pursuit of becoming something that was clear to them and different to the rest of the industry, Continental gets a little frustrated, and just exactly what any non-essentialist would do. They say, well, we'll just be both. They did what we would call a straddled strategy. They said, well, we're going to be the traditional company that we are, plus, we're going to add a new service called Continental Light, and that will run not in 2 separate companies, but in the same one. It introduced so much confusion, it's hard even to state. If you can imagine, they set the records for number of complaints per day, and I'll remind you, we're talking about the airline industry. It deserves its own sort of prize to win that, and they lost $150 million and eventually fired the CEO. It was a complete disaster, but that's a bold example to illustrate the risks of just trying to do everything that everyone else is doing. You've got to have deep insight about what you are and you aren't, and keep working on that so that you can reap the benefits of a consistent strategy.
Now that's it for the first part of our conversation with Greg. If you'd like to hear more of my initial thoughts from a couple of years ago on how to apply essentialism to our team, check out episode 18, Essentialism and Coaching. I'll put a link in the episode details of this podcast. Also, I highly recommend that you check out the movie Forever Strong. I'll put a link of that in the coaching notes. I believe it's out on Netflix as well. Lastly, you're not going to want to miss next week's episode with Greg McEwen. It was one of the most impactful conversations I've ever had with anyone in my entire life.